Hey, podcast listeners, welcome to the Psychology of Games podcast. My name is Jamie Madigan, and I write, lecture, and podcast about the intersection of psychology and video games. This episode of the podcast that you're listening to is a little bit of a different beast. One of the benefits of being a Patreon supporter is that I create audio versions of the articles that I write and post over at psychologyofgames.com, and then I post those audio versions over on the Patreon website for people to listen to. This episode of the podcast is a collection of the first 12 such audio articles that I created, and they've sort of been stitched together for your convenience and your listening pleasure. If you want to hear more recent versions of articles like this and listen to those, or if you want to listen to future versions of articles that get published, you can go over to the Patreon website, patreon.com/POG, that's for Psychology of Games, and you can consider becoming a supporter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Free money, grocery bags, and smarter than you. Luca Redwood is a UK-based game developer who, in 2012, scored a mobile game hit with an awkwardly named Match 3 role-playing game, 10 Million. And then more recently, he released the sequel, You Must Build a Boat. Between those two games, though, Redwood released a peculiar dueling game called Smarter Than You. It's like rock, paper, scissors in that sword beats arrow, arrow beats counter, and counter beats sword, but you can also bluff before each attack by using a menu of words to build sentences. You could say, for example, arrow looks like a good choice, but you don't actually have to take your own advice. You could hope to throw your opponent off and choose counter instead. But what really interests me about Smarter Than You is what happens at the end of a match. You have the option of tipping your opponent. The game features an experience point and leveling system which unlocks cosmetic items. Besides winning matches, you can also receive experience as a gift from an opponent. But here's the weird part. Tips were originally done through in-app purchases only. After a match, a little slot machine wheel would spin and you'd randomly get the option of either paying $1, $2, or $3 to give your opponent some bonus experience points. You could choose not to tip any experience points at all, if you like, but if you did tip, it costs you real money to give them bonus experience points, for which you got nothing but warm fuzzies. That's weird, right? You'd not be alone to think so. I contacted Redwood and asked him how many people tipped using this system. He said, quote, "For me, at least, this was a big surprise. People paying real money to give their partners a bonus didn't happen very often. I think I've had a total of 2,000 to 3,000 paid tips. While it's amazing to think that those people paid real money to benefit their partner, out of millions of games, it's a very small percentage," end quote. Well, in actuality, it's beyond very small if millions of games were played. It's essentially 0.0% after you round off. So generosity wasn't much of a moneymaker. Then, about a week after launching the game, Redwood got an idea. What if people could exchange something that's free, such as their time, for a tip instead? Watching a 15-second commercial is a common monetization tactic for free-to-play games because it's a way to get something out of those without credit cards. Kids, for example. Said Redwood, quote, "I had the player play a virtual version of me for the tutorial. After they beat me, they could tweet at me and brag. The game had millions of downloads, so I got thousands of these tweets, and a lot of them were from younger kids, age 8 to 15, who I figured wouldn't have a credit card and couldn't join in the tipping game, even if they wanted to." So, Redwood added a fourth possible outcome to the slot machine reel, watch an ad. If you get that option and choose it, you watch an advertisement, and your opponent gets the benefit. What more, they don't know if you actually watched an ad or paid real money to give them that tip. This worked out much better for everybody involved. According to Redwood, the percentage of tippers went from 0% to 60%, 6-0. That's a huge increase, far more than you would expect from a linear relationship between cost and benefit. So instead of paying real money for virtual currency or some other in-game benefit, any player could now watch a short video that some advertiser had paid Redwood to put in. It was like the players were being paid for their attention. This lines up with some other research I've read about the irrational way that we treat zero as a price. That is, how we treat free. In 2007, Christina Champagnier, Nina Mazar, and Dan Ariely published a study in Marketing Science that may shed some light on why the watch an ad option in Redwood's game might have been so popular. So consider this question, which the researchers posed to some of the participants in this study. Would you rather, 1. Buy a $20 Amazon.com gift card for $8, or 2. Buy a $10 Amazon.com gift card for $1. So if you think about that, it's a bargain either way, but most people, 64%, chose to pay $8 for the $20 gift card because it netted them $12 in credit. $20 minus $8 is $12. Whereas the other option only got them $9. But then the researchers dropped the price of both cards by $1 and then asked the revised question. Would you rather, one, buy a $20 Amazon.com gift card for $7, or two, get a $10 Amazon.com gift card for free? Because the price of each option had changed by the same amount, $1, the ratio of cost to value was unchanged, and the $20 card was still the better value. But we evaluate free according to different rules than other prices, so every single person in the study, 100%, they took the free gift card even though it netted them less money in Amazon credit. As another example how this works, let's fast travel to Argentina. In an attempt at reducing litter and waste, a few years ago, Buenos Aires began charging the equivalent of 2.5 cents in taxes for using plastic grocery bags supplied by grocery stores. Or, as an alternative, you could bring your own bags and pay no fee. Because the rule was phased in, it provided an opportunity for a natural experiment where researchers compared behavior at stores with and without the fee. The results were pretty clear. Up to 90% of shoppers helped themselves to the plastic bags at stores where they were free because the fee hadn't yet been implemented, but that dropped to 40% at stores where the bags cost a mere 2.5 cents. Again, the preference for free was disproportionate and alluring. And so I think it is with free tipping by watching an ad in Smarter Than You. You could choose just not to tip, but since you do, presumably, get some utility out of tipping in the form of satisfaction and warm fuzzies, the free option is far more tempting than the cheap $1 option. In fact, I think it would still outperform a paid option even if Redwood were able to charge only 1 cent for tipping. And in fact, in the spirit of further experimentation, I suggested to Redwood that he try this setup. First, incorporate virtual currency into Smarter Than You so that you can use it to tip instead of real money. So sell, say, 100 purple diamonds for $1. Then, instead of randomizing the options at the end of the match, split the players into two groups and give each 3 choices on how to tip. Group A would get these choices. 1. Pay 15 purple diamonds to award 1,000 experience points to your opponent. 2. Pay 1 purple diamond and award 100 experience points. 3. Don't tip at all. Then, you'd give Group B these options. 1. Pay 14 purple diamonds and award 1,000 experience points to your opponent. 2. Watch an ad and award 100 experience points. 3. Don't tip at all. If the Champagnier, Mazar, and Areli experience is any indication, most people in Group A would spend the 15 diamonds to award 1,000 points. But most people in Group B will be irrational, and they will elect to watch the ad instead. But what would be interesting to find out is if these options in Group B generated more tipping, and thus more revenue for the game developer, overall, because of those choices in the way that we treat free irrationally. So somebody get on that experiment and let me know how it goes.
When the pay-to-win button backfires. What do you think of people who pay real money for advantages in multiplayer games? Talking about things like more powerful weapons, higher-level avatars, damage boosters, or experience point doublers. Do you curl your lip and look at them down your nose? Do you hate them? Do you hate them so much? If so, you're like many of the subjects in research conducted by Ellen Ebers, Niels van de Ven, and Doris Wiede. The team presents its findings in a new article entitled "The Hidden Cost of Microtransactions, Buying In-Game Advantages in Online Games Decreases a Player's Status." The authors use social comparison theory and research on envy as starting points to explore how other players react to those who are caught coughing up cash to jam on the pay-to-win button. In short, social comparison theory says that in the absence of meaningful data on how well off we are or how well we're doing, we habitually turn to comparisons with other people to form some kind of judgment. Am I hungry or too warm? I can answer those kind of questions based on internal evaluations. But for questions about whether I make a lot of money or how good I am at the video game Rocket League, I need information about other people to place myself on some kind of continuum. Having to make an upward social comparison where I come out looking bad relative to somebody else can make me see myself as inferior. That's unpleasant for me, but hey, that's how it is. It seems pretty natural for more powerful or capable players to be higher status. But Evers, van de Ven, and Wiede argue that these social comparisons in video games are complicated by in-game purchases that gives players advantages. When somebody buys an advantage, it elevates their well-being, which makes me feel worse. And what's more, the psychological effects of envy and perceptions of injustice can enter the picture if I don't feel that they earned that advantage fairly. This is the kind of potential reaction that the researchers were interested in. Each of the three studies discussed in their paper looked at a different game. One looked at people buying in-game boosters for Maple Story, a free-to-play, massively multiplayer role-playing game. One looked at the use of gold versus real money auction houses that were, at the time, part of the action RPG game Diablo III. And one considered people who paid real money for more powerful tanks in World of Tanks, a free-to-play, massively multiplayer action game, instead of earning those tanks through in-game grinding. Procedure for each of the studies differed a bit, but the gist is that the researchers recruited players, then asked them to imagine other players in the game who bought an item or boost that gave them an in-game advantage. They then asked players a series of questions designed to measure their attitudes towards that person and likely interactions with him. Did they respect the player? Did they envy him? Did they want them on their team? Would they stop to revive them or just walk past them like some stone-cold mother effer? The primary finding is that players who pay to win are indeed respected less by their fellow players. Players also view them as less inherently skilled. Conversely, players said that they were more likely to respect other players who actually had earned what they had. Second, players indeed felt some amount of ill will towards those who paid for advantages. They said they would be amused by the other person's failure. They were less likely to say they wanted the person on their team. But despite all this, one of the more interesting findings was that when confronted with another person who paid for advantages, players reported more temptation to spend real money themselves in order to even the odds. Though perhaps this isn't too surprising given what we know about the effects of envy. So this paper is preliminary, relying as it does on self-reported survey data instead of actual player behaviors. But as far as I know, it's the first to directly examine people's attitudes towards in-game purchases using an established psychological theory. There's lots of ways to expand this research here. Does envy cause increases in actual spending of money? Do players drop out of matches more if they get paired with somebody who paid for an advantage? Could you do a content analysis of text or voice chat in games to see if these people try to lower their social status in response to perceived unfairness? Do those who pay for advantages have fewer people on their friends list or get fewer friends invites? Do these effects extend outside the game session itself to social comparisons facilitated by leaderboards, rankings, achievement trackers, and the like? Well, here's to hoping for future studies. The Shenmue 3 Kickstarter and the Affect Heuristic. You know the craziest thing I saw in any of this year's E3 press conferences? It was when Sony promoted a Kickstarter for Yu Suzuki's Shenmue 3. The fact that one of the biggest players in the video game business would give Suzuki a platform to promote his crowdfunded sequel to a 14-year-old action-adventure Dreamcast game is, well, it's indicative of the interesting times in which we live. And apparently a lot of people found the idea of a Shenmue sequel very interesting. The Kickstarter raised $6.33 million from 69,320 fans, far beyond its initial goal of $2 million. Of course, I wonder about the psychology behind somebody's decision to put money into this project, and I think one of the most common decision-making biases that we know of was in play, the affect heuristic. The term, first coined by psychologist Paul Slovic, describes our tendency to let our feelings, our affects, about something dominate other evaluations of it. If your work supervisor elicits positive emotions from you, you're more likely to attend to his virtues and downplay his faults. And if a law or policy is cast in a light that elicits negative emotions, such as, "This is a war on Christmas," then people tend to pay more attention to it and support arguments against it. This happens because the question, "Is this person or policy or product good?" is a hard question to answer. Whereas, "How does this person, policy, or product make me feel?" is a much easier question. Our minds have a persistent habit of slyly substituting easy questions for hard ones whenever they get the chance. I think this is going on with the Shenmue 3 Kickstarter. The question, should I support this project, is a tough one to answer. Answering it relies on the answers to many other questions. Here's just a few. Will Yu Suzuki be able to make the game with the money he gets out of this? Even if he can, will it be enough to let him make the game he wants? Is the game he wants to make also the one that I will want to play? I mean, what is a Shenmue game released in 2017 even going to look like? Do I have any evidence that Suzuki can lead a team to make a modern game? If Suzuki does create a modern game, will it still capture what I loved about the first two games? And then if he doesn't modernize it, would I actually be able to enjoy playing an old-style game more like the first two? And have you guys seen any sailors? These are tough questions. Some of them are probably impossible to answer right now, so you'd have to resort to assigning probabilities to various outcomes. That's even tougher. But you know what's an easy question to answer? Does thinking about Shenmue make me happy? And because that's such an easy question to answer, it's probably the one that most influences people's decisions on the topic. The answer to one question unconsciously substituted for another. The Kuleshov Effect and Emergent Narratives. A while back, I had AI expert Dave Mark on my podcast. One of the things that he talked about in the context of using psychology to shape player behavior was the Kuleshov Effect. I wanted to take a closer look at that topic in detail today. So, the effect is named after a Soviet filmmaker of the same name who created many montages and showed that the context of one shot could change the viewer's perception of another. Imagine, for example, you have four small clips of film. One shows a man staring blankly into the camera. Another shows a bowl of soup. A third shows a sexy lady. The last shows a dead child. Now, take three groups of people. Show one group just a shot of the soup followed by a shot of the man staring into the camera. Show another group just the sexy lady followed by a shot of the man. And then finally, take the third group and show them just the dead child followed by the man. Note that it's the same exact shot of the man in all three groups. The only difference is the shot that precedes it. Actually, you don't have to imagine all of this. I'll include a link to a YouTube video of the clips that Kuleshov used in the comments. So, now that you've got these clips in these groups, ask everyone to describe the man and what he's thinking. What researchers have found is that people's perceptions of the man in the shot are greatly influenced by the context created by the other part of the clip. Those who saw the soup were more likely to say that the man looked hungry. Those who saw the woman reported a lascivious look in the man's eyes. And those who saw the dead child reported seeing that the man's expression bent to sorrow. When faced with an ambiguous situation or stimulus, we immediately lean on contextual information for clues and guidance on what information to attend to, how to interpret it, and even what to remember. In my mind, this also relates to what's called the fundamental attribution error, which describes how we tend to blame internal states for the behaviors of other people, but blame our behaviors on external factors when we're talking about our own. So, for example, that person is crossing her arms because she's unfriendly, but we're crossing our arms because it's cold in here. When contextual information supports this fundamental attribution error bias, it's even more likely to be used to make sense of an ambiguous situation. So, as in film, the Kuleshov effect and the fundamental attribution error can be leveraged by game designers to add a little depth to their game world. And the best part is that it can be often the players themselves who are creating the backstories, justifications, and narratives. If you're playing in an open-world game and you come across two NPCs having a chat in town, that's just background decoration that you barely notice. But find those same NPCs with the same animations and the same chatter while exploring woods outside of town? What's up with that? Are they up to something nefarious? Something scandalous? The answer could emerge out of the player's situation, whether she found them there at night, while there were animals about, while there were enemies about, whatever. It could be different every time. We also see this come up a lot in games like those in the Dark Souls series. Why are these creatures here at this particular location in possession of these particular items? Little details create bigger context which impel players to make up their own minds. And sometimes that's a lot more fun. And sometimes it's hilarious. I recently played Batman Arkham Knight and noticed the Kuleshov effect in action. At several points when Batman has a conversation with an NPC, he takes on an expression much like the man in the Kuleshov clips. The Bats is just dead-eyed, expressionless, and stares into the middle distance while the firefighter he just rescued earnestly thanks him for saving the day. This happens over and over, and I soon started believing my own narrative that Batman was just a hair's breadth away from flipping out. He was seconds away from buckling under all the pressure, all the scarecrow toxin, and the general overwhelming hell that his life had become that night. He was just ready to snap and break this firefighter in half at any second. This was aided by the context of Arkham Knight's storyline, and that situation with Batman and the firefighter suddenly got a lot more tense, all because of one blank stare. The Wee Little Fluency Effect. Do you remember what your reaction was to hearing the name Nintendo Wii for the first time? What about its follow-up, the Wii U? Like a lot of people, you may have snorted in laughter or at least arched one dubious eyebrow. I remember very much wanting to know what the other more explicit names Nintendo had rejected were. What names could have been sillier or sounded more like a bodily function?
Wii and Wii U may sound silly, but Nintendo may have been onto something. Intentionally or not, they may have been capitalizing on a psychological phenomenon called the fluency effect. Some psychologists studying language and names say that monikers like Bob or Ann are fluent to native English speakers, for example. While more difficult to pronounce names like Kina, Q-U-I-N-A, or Geralyn, G-E-R-A-L-Y-N, are disfluent. Adam Alter discusses fluency in detail early in his book Drunk Tank Pink, and offers this litmus test for determining if a name is closer to disfluent than it is fluent. Imagine you're a presenter in front of a huge crowd like the Academy Awards, and you're announcing an award winner. Do you get nervous when you open the envelope and see the name? By this measure, the Wii seems like a pretty fluent name for most of us. What's more, Alter describes research showing that life tends to be slightly easier for those with fluent names. People can remember them more easily. Disfluent names, however, can trigger the halo effect, where the difficulty of saying or remembering someone's name can bleed over into unconscious global evaluations about them. Alter and two of his colleagues conducted a study where they found that the fluency of lawyers' names helped predict whether or not they got a boost early in their career. The effect even existed independent of the person's ethnicity. It persisted even when the researcher considered only Anglo-American names. But that's people, and the Wii is a product, right? To prove that the effect extended beyond people, Alter and his colleagues did another experiment looking at company names listed on the New York Stock Exchange between 1990 and 2004. They hypothesized that since determining the value of a company is such a massively difficult task, the fluency of the company's name might exert some influence. Investors feel better about fluent names, and that feeling bleeds over, unconsciously probably, to their evaluation of the stock. Indeed, companies with more fluent names did better. Alter points out that an investment in the 10 stocks with the most fluent names would earn an 11% return, while the 10 most disfluently named stocks would get you only 4%. If Wii and Wii U are more fluent names than Xbox or PlayStation, then Nintendo probably benefited some from the fluency effect. Lord knows they're more fluent than Ouya. But there's another reason that Nintendo might have chosen that name: the psychological power of phonemes. Some spoken sounds just seem like they have certain qualities. Some time ago, German psychologist Wolfgang Kohler proposed a simple thought experiment that illustrates this idea. Consider two shapes, one blob-like and made from curves, and the other angular and made with straight lines. Which of these do you think is more likely to be called Maluma, and which do you think is Takete? Most people think the rounder, smoother shape is Maluma, and the other angular shape is Takete. It proved to be a very robust finding that extended to kids who were too young to read or write the two names. Likewise, Wii suggests something round, friendly, playful. It's not coincidental that it sounds just like the sound kids make going down a playground slide. Or some adults, for that matter. Reason-based choice of a golden path. A few months ago, I finished Far Cry 4. It's an open-world, first-person shooter set amidst political change in a fictional Himalayan country. In the course of shooting everything that moves, your character becomes entangled with the Golden Path, a group of rebels trying to overthrow a very well-dressed and oddly charming dictator. Two people struggle for control and leadership of the Golden Path, Amida and Sabal. Amida is harshly pragmatic, but socially progressive. She wants better rights for women, for example, but she's willing to fund the revolution by selling opium. Sabal, on the other hand, struck me as staying closer to the middle of the road. He was charming and had boundless compassion for his fellow soldiers, but he also wanted to maintain a cultural heritage that included traditional social castes. It's just kind of milquetoast, especially next to the extreme highs and lows of Amida's agenda. As a player, this was an interesting choice. Both Amida and Sabal had good and bad qualities by my standards. Yet, completing the game eventually required me to take a stand and support one leader over the other. I deliberated carefully when the point of no return came, but I made my choice as to who the story's main character would back. I chose Amida for what it's worth, though I really liked Sabal's character and felt kind of bad about it. After that choice was made, though, I was all in. I started thinking about what Amida was fighting for, how it aligned with my values. She was for progress, right? Progress is good. Let's just ignore the time she wanted me to let her fellow soldiers die so I could instead pursue some valuable information. And that whole, let's fund a war by controlling the opium trade thing. What I was doing was rationalizing my choice. I was paying attention to information that supported the correctness of my decision and ignoring information that called it into question. Or did it go back even further than that? Had the way the choice between Amita and Sabal been presented made me choose one over the other? This, in turn, made me think specifically of a study by Eldar Shafir, Itamar Simonson, and Amos Tversky that shows how decisions can be biased by framing them in certain ways, so that we seek out some pieces of information and ignore others. In their paper, the authors observe that we often fall into what they call reason-based models of decision-making, where we search, sometimes retroactively, for reasons to support the choices we make. This is as opposed to a rational approach where we assign values to all options and outcomes and then just leave it to the map. This reason-based approach makes us susceptible to framing effects and the nuances of language when we're presented with a choice. One example is being asked to either choose or reject one option out of two that have equal value. That is, choice A and choice B differ across a few dimensions, but those differences cancel each other out when taken as a whole. All things considered, choice A and B are equal value. If that's true, then choosing one of the options should be the same as rejecting the other. To make things more concrete, the authors described an experiment from another study in which they asked subjects to play the role of a juror on a child custody case. Quote, imagine that you serve on the jury of an only child sole custody case following a relatively messy divorce. The facts of the case are complicated by ambiguous economic, social, and emotional considerations, and you decide to base your decision entirely on the following few observations. Parent A has average income, average health, average working hours, a reasonable rapport with the child, and relatively stable social life. Parent B has above average income, very close relationship with the child, extremely active social life, lots of work-related travel, and minor health problems. End quote. So, look at those lists, and you'll see that the parent A is just kind of average. No great qualities, no bad ones. Parent B, though, has some great qualities. Above average income, very good relationship with the child. But also some bad ones. Travels a lot, and some health problems. They are, in a way, somewhat like Sabal and Amita. The researchers, having split the subjects into two groups, played with the phrasing of the choice to see how our reason-based approach of choosing between similar options can be used to nudge things towards one parent or the other. They asked either, quote, to which parent would you award sole custody of the child, end quote, or, quote, which parent would you deny sole custody of the child to, end quote. If the choices were equal, or even approximately equal, then the phrasing shouldn't matter, right? Well, it did matter. When asked whom they would award custody to, 64% saw parent B as the better choice. But when asked whom to deny custody to, the preference flipped and only 45% chose to give parent B custody. Why? Because the words award or deny set off searches for justifications for those decisions. People looking for a reason to award custody zeroed in on the higher income and good parent-child relationship of parent B. And those looking for a reason to deny custody to somebody zeroed in on that same person's health problems and travel schedule. The phrasing of the decision biased them towards paying attention to and using certain information. And so it may have been with Sabal and Amita. If I recall, the tutorial text in the game tells you to, quote, choose who to support, end quote, when Amita and Sabal are at loggerheads. Would I have chosen differently if it had said, choose who to betray? Or choose who to reject? I might have. Point is, if you're a game designer presenting the player with a big decision, your choice of words matter. And if you're a player, once in a while try looking at things differently simply by rephrasing the choice before you pull the trigger.
The Steam Winter Sale is too much sale. Let's say you're Valve. Hello, Valve. I noticed you've started your winter Steam sale again. That's awesome, but I've noticed you're doing something slightly different this year. In the past, you've metered out the sale prices in the form of daily deals and flash sales that rotate every 8 hours or so. We had to come back to the site constantly to see what was on sale. This year, though, you're just sort of putting everything on sale at once. A little further down the homepage, it says that there are 4,076 titles on sale across Steam for me. That's a lot of options to consider. Why the change? There's actually many reasons why the rotating sales worked well. Plus, the entirety of Chapter 9 in my book deals with digital sales and expands on that topic.
But there's another reason why I think this year's put it all on sale now strategy is a bad idea. Sometimes too many options can be demotivating. Too many choices can, in fact, lead to making no choice at all. Someone assuming that all shoppers are completely rational and have no boundaries around their mental abilities would also assume that more choices are probably better than fewer. Maybe it's that way in Vulcan supermarkets, and Spock would have no problem choosing between 300 options for canned corn or indie platforming games. But that's just not how human brains work. Back in 2000, Sheena Iyengar and Mark Lepper published a series of studies where they tested the assumption that having more choices is always better. In their first experiment, they set up a booth at an upscale supermarket where they invited shoppers to sample different kinds of Wilkins & Sons jams. Some shoppers were presented with a choice of 6 different jams, while others had 24 different flavors to choose from. They then measured how many people from each group ended up buying a jar of jam. It stands to reason that those who had more choices would be more likely to find something they really liked and buy it, right? Here's what the researchers found. Of those with 6 options, 31% bought something. Of those with 24 options, 3% bought something. Huh. Next, the researchers offered a bunch of college students the opportunity to write an essay for extra credit in a psychology class. The essay was optional, so nobody was required to do it. But if they did, they had to choose from a pre-approved list of topics. Half the students were given a list of 6 essay topics to choose from, while the other were given a long list of 30 choices. Here's what they found. Of those with 6 options, 74% did the extra credit assignment. Of those with 30 options, 60% did it. Not as big a difference from the grocery shoppers, but still a lot. The researchers also found that people faced with lots of choices reported being happier about the situation than those with only a few, but those same people also said that they found the experience more difficult and more frustrating. Given that, why did those with 4 to 5 times as many choices decide so often not to exercise any of them? Because when faced with an overwhelming number of choices, we quickly lose our ability to compare them all at once, so we look for choice strategies that make comparisons easy. We jettison choices that are dissimilar to others. We focus on just a few limited characteristics. We overweigh characteristics that are easy to quantify and understand. We stop perusing as soon as we find one option that meets some minimum threshold. But even those strategies can be difficult, so a lot of times we just go with the status quo. We walk away without making any choice because that's the easiest way out of a frustrating and mentally taxing situation. This is why, among other reasons, it's better for Valve to offer, or at least promote, daily deals with a relatively limited list of titles. If they just put up a big list of 4,000 games, we'd be less likely to buy something because it would overwhelm our normal choice strategies. Too much choice is demotivating. Learned Helplessness in Halo 5. I picked up Halo 5 around the time that it came out and had a good enough time with the single-player campaign. For many, though, the game's real draw is its competitive multiplayer. I didn't jump into that right away, though, because of the experiences I'd had with Halo 4's multiplayer. Specifically, I got stomped whenever I tried to join a game. Just utter, undeniable, and consistent failure. So much so that I felt helpless and gave up. I bet some of you out there have had similar experiences with other shooters, like Call of Duty or other competitive games like Dota 2 or StarCraft. Heck, you don't even have to limit it to competitive games. Games that revel in difficulty like Super Meat Boy, Trials Evolution, and Spelunky can create the same sense of helplessness in the face of failure. Yet, some people persist. They continue to bang their heads against the games until they get good, or beat a level, or get an S rank. It's like something clicks in their heads and they refuse to accept that they can't succeed eventually. Or maybe it's that something doesn't click. Psychologists have studied how we feel helpless for decades. Early experiments by psychologist and animal rights non-activist Martin Seligman were pretty messed up. In part one of one experiment, researchers put dogs in a box with a metallic floor that could be electrocuted. When the shocking of doggy paws started, Group A had a lever in their box that they could nudge to turn off the juice. They pretty quickly figured this out. Group B, though, wasn't presented with a reliable way to turn off the shocks. They just had to lie there and take it. Yeah, I know, sorry to make you sad like that, but rest assured that if this experiment were proposed today, it would never be allowed. They'd have to make do with undergraduate college students instead. In part two of the experiment, The researchers took the same groups of dogs from part one and put them in similar shock boxes, only this one was bisected by a low partition wall. Once the shocking started, the dogs that had been in group A, the ones that had learned they could turn off the shocks in the previous box, started seeking escape and learned that they could simply hop over the partition to safety. The dogs in group B, the ones who couldn't escape the shocks previously, they didn't even try to escape. They just curled up and suffered. In Seligman's words, they had acquired learned helplessness. This is a concept that has been applied to many parts of human life. School, the workplace, sports, games. We can learn to feel helpless because of seemingly unavoidable failure in one situation, then carry that psychological burden with us to new situations where we immediately or quickly give up. In many ways, this is what happened to me in the Halo games. Getting curb stomped in competitive play made me assume that all future experiences would be the same. They may have even made me doubt my ability to play action games in general. It's something I assume game developers want to avoid as much as players do. Fortunately, Seligman went on to refine his model of learned helplessness in a way that suggests how we can avoid falling into this trap, and some ways that game developers can help us make better attributions for our failures so that we can enjoy their games more. In a paper entitled Learned Helplessness in Humans, Seligman argues that the attributions we make for our failures, that is, the things that we blame for them, they vary along three dimensions: internal versus external, stable versus unstable, global versus specific. Internal versus external attributions deals with whether or not you think that the ability to succeed is absent in just you or absent from everyone. I studied but can't pass this class even though everyone else in the class could. This is an internal attribution. I couldn't save the child from leukemia because leukemia is incurable is an external attribution. Global versus specific attributions deals with whether or not you feel helpless in all or most situations, or if you feel helpless only in this one situation. Consider a student who gets a bad grade on a paper. I'm stupid is a global attribution. The teacher who graded the paper hates me is a specific attribution. Chronic versus transient attributions deals with whether we think the helplessness is long-lived or frequently occurring, or whether we think it's short-lived and non-recurring. Consider a soccer player who misses a penalty shot at the goal. The goalie is too good is a chronic attribution. The sun was in my eyes is a transient attribution. So, like everything else, the worst attributions when it comes to dealing with failure in video games are internal, global, and chronic ones. Everyone but me is able to understand this combo system in this fighting game. That's an internal attribution. My reflexes are so slow, people shoot me before I can react to seeing them. That's a global attribution. And my internet service is too slow to play competitively. That's a chronic attribution. They're all attributions that are more likely to make you feel helpless. And when you feel helpless, you're more likely to just give up. On the other hand, the X button on this controller doesn't work half the time. That's a specific attribution. My little brother is downloading porn on his laptop again, which makes my game lag. That's a transient attribution. These are reasons for failure that we can deal with, and we can hold out hopes that we might be able to succeed in the future, maybe even the near future. As a footnote, external attributions, for example, this game is so janky and broken that winning is essentially random, don't really create learned helplessness since we have an external source to blame for failure, but they do kill our hopes that we will be able to succeed in the future. So, players, when met with failure, should look for different things to blame. Blame hackers and find another server. Decide that it's your team that sucks, not you. Maybe you're having trouble because it's super late and you're tired. I mean, don't actually say these things in game chat or out loud. That would make you kind of a jerk, but at least you wouldn't be a helpless jerk. Game developers, on the other hand, might take all of this and try to surface information about the game that nudges players towards specific transient attributions for their failure. If you're a developer who's tackled this issue, I'd love to hear about it in the comments. Now, if you'll excuse me, now that I'm well rested, have a working controller, and I've killed all the downloads on my network, I'm going to try some Halo 5 multiplayer. Newtonian Engagement, and Metal Gear Solid 5. I was recently working through my backlog of things I'd filed away to read or watch and came across a presentation given by Nils Pill, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, at GDC China in 2013. I've included a link to it in the notes for this post. There's a lot of good stuff in there, but one new concept that stuck out to me. Pill, whose company Mention LLC consults with game developers, calls it Newtonian engagement. The name is in reference to Isaac Newton's first law of motion, which essentially states that when an object is set in motion, it'll continue that motion until acted upon by an outside force. Fling something into the vacuum of space, and it'll keep going in a line until it gets caught up in an external force like gravity or some astronaut's face. Bending the idea so that it could be turned to game design, Pill says that, quote, an engaged player will remain engaged until acted upon by an outside force, end quote. Once we're engaged, we keep playing until somebody calls us to dinner or the clock tells us that it's time to go to work or something else. This triggers what Pill calls a reevaluation point. We pause to think, should I keep playing or should I do something else? You might be aware of this decision that you're making, or it might happen subconsciously. This, by the way, is why there's no clocks in casinos. They don't want you noticing how late it's gotten. They want you to keep playing. The insight I thought was interesting was that it's often the game that provides the player with new information to trigger a reevaluation point. When you liberate a tower in Assassin's Creed or peruse a bounty board in The Witcher 3, the game floods you with new information and side quests and points of interest. Faced with this new information, and the fact that you just finished the task you were engaged in, you now have to pause to consider what to do next. This is a reevaluation point, and we often decide right then and there to take a break or go to bed or go get something to eat. Pills goes into a lot more detail about the substeps that happen at every reevaluation point and how game developers can use that information to shape players' perceptions and behavior. You can watch the video to get all that. It occurs to me that some games are much worse at avoiding these reevaluation points than are others. Take Metal Gear Solid 5, for example. Whenever you finish a mission in that game, you typically have to exit the battlefield and hop in a helicopter, which takes you to a kind of holding area or lobby. You then have to navigate a couple of menus, maybe check the upgrade research on your base developments, select your next mission, listen to a briefing, go through several more menus to select your loadouts and your buddy's loadouts, sit through a loading screen disguised as a helicopter ride, and then finally get on to the next mission. And yeah, I know you can just run around the open world part and do side quests, but those things are so far flung that you're going to open up menus to request a helicopter pickup, or at least your horse buddy so you don't have to walk everywhere. All that stuff breaks up any Newtonian engagement you might have and gives you an opportunity to think about what to do next, which might be something other than continuing to play the game. Now consider a game like Shadow of Mordor. Instead of being broken up into chunks of missions and quests like Destiny or Metal Gear Solid, the game simply has objectives that flow naturally from one to another. If you try to tackle a stealth kill objective and fail, the game world just continues on, and so do you. There's a smaller chance of reevaluation points happening because your engagement with the game hasn't hit a brick wall in the form of a mission failed screen or a press A to try again option. The player's attention just flows to the next nearby thing in the game, which might be the waypoint to retry the stealth mission, or it might be the arrival of some orcish nemesis or something else. Same thing happens if you succeed at that stealth mission. No backing out through a bunch of menus or hub areas to pick a new objective. The point is that if a developer wants a game to be engaging, it succeeds more to the extent that it removes such roadblocks and lets your engagement travel in a straight line from one event to another. Red versus blue. Which should you choose? Chess may have its black versus white color scheme, but for video games, it's often red versus blue. It's the kind of matchup that you find in dozens of games once you start looking for it, whether it's the color of your avatar, the heads-up display, or both. Sometimes you're randomly assigned to a team when you join, but other times you can choose. Is there an advantage to picking red or blue? Well, yeah, maybe. A little bit. I just finished reading the book Drunk Tank Pink and Other Unexpected Forces That Shape How We Think, Feel, and Behave by Adam Alter. One chapter deals with how the color of a uniform can affect performance in a competitive sport. Alter cites a 2005 study that looked at Olympic athletes participating in one-on-one combat sports like boxing, taekwondo, Greco-Roman wrestling, and freestyle wrestling. The rules of the Olympics stipulate that one competitor is randomly assigned a blue outfit while the other gets red. Thus, it was a great opportunity for a natural experiment on the effects of uniform color on performance. The researchers found that those wearing red uniforms won a statistically significant larger portion of their matches. The author's theory, which is also Drunk Tank Pink author Dan, which is also Drunk Tank Pink author Adam Alter's theory, is that throughout nature, the color red is associated with heightened aggression, dominance, and testosterone levels. Think of mating season or fighting season. Skin gets flushed and animals display the red bits of their bodies while engaging in dominant and aggressive behavior. I know, it sounds a bit far-fetched in the context of humans participating in sports, but the idea is simply that wearing the color red primes competitors to think about being particularly aggressive and dominating. That is, it makes thoughts about those concepts come to mind quicker and more easily. In sports like boxing or taekwondo, where aggression makes you more competitive, this matters. Wearing red, the researchers argue, essentially makes it a little easier for you to get pumped up and visualize the kind of behavior that wins bouts. The competitor in blue might compound the effect by perceiving his or her red opponent as more intimidating or imposing. This might all even be subconscious. It probably is, in fact. And athletes aren't the only ones affected. Alter also cites another study that showed how referees can be affected by the same principle. In the study, professional taekwondo referees watched recordings of red and blue competitors trying to knock the stuffing out of each other. Per the official rules of the World Taekwondo Federation, the referees awarded points to specific types of blows. Here's the trick, though. For half the referees, the researchers digitally altered the footage to swap the red and blue colors on the athletes' uniforms. So the footage was exactly the same as that seen by other referees, except the blue competitors were now red and vice versa. The result? Both sets of referees gave more points on average to those athletes in red uniforms and less to those in blue. The color of the uniform affected their judgment independently of their performance, presumably because it tapped into some unconscious bias the judges had for thinking that someone in red was more aggressive and more dominating. This wasn't the first study of uniform color either. Back in the 1980s, Mark Frank and Thomas Gilovich looked at the number of penalties earned by teams in the National Football League and National Hockey League that wore black uniforms. They found that those wearing black, a color typically associated with the wardrobes of the villainous, were found by referees to be more guilty of infractions, fouls, and rule violations relative to those wearing light-colored jerseys. Does the same thing happen in video games? Yeah, sometimes at least. One 2008 study published in the journal Cyberpsychology and Behavior scraped data from 1,347 Unreal Tournament 2004 matches. They found that red teams won about 5% more matches than blue, which is far more than you would expect from chance alone. There is a caveat to this, though. This seeing red effect isn't huge and won't be the deciding factor in anything but a very close competition. The 2004 study by Hill and Barton confirmed this. When competitors were mismatched, such as a heavyweight boxer wailing on a middleweight, the advantage afforded by wearing a red uniform went away. Similarly, a pro gamer isn't going to lose to a scrub simply because she was randomly assigned to blue. So, should you pick the red team when in a video game when you get the choice? More research on games is needed, but all else being equal, these studies suggest that it couldn't hurt. Might help, actually.
Overwatch, the team-based first-person shooter from Blizzard, is coming out this month. I was lucky enough to get into the closed beta, so I've actually been playing it for months at this point, and I can tell you that it's great. Overwatch does a ton of neat little things to nudge players towards good or otherwise beneficial behavior. If your team needs somebody to play a healer or a tank class, for example, the game will alert you to that on the hero select screen. Characters will also constantly call out things that they need to be doing, like standing on the capture point or taking out an enemy turret. The game also automates some good sportsmanship behaviors like thanking other players who heal or shield you. The game also has a kill cam feature that, when bested by another player, shows you the action from the killer's perspective. It's kind of a nice feature that lets you see what did you in and hopefully learn from it. Or maybe you'll just get furious and yell into your mic. Like any game, Overwatch players are going to have to deal with people for whom sportsmanship is alien. But I think there's an opportunity that Blizzard missed with the kill cam, and one little tweak might put frustrated players on better behavior. It has to do with what's called self-perception theory,
which deals with how we crave consistency between our actions and our attitudes. It's a watershed concept in social psychology pioneered by physicist-turned-psychologist Daryl Bem during the 1960s. The theory says that in any given situation, we think, at some level, about how a third party would view our actions and our behaviors. We then change our beliefs and attitudes to match the imaginary person's expectations of us. We are concluding that our behavior must be caused by our attitudes, and since attitudes are often easier to change than the reality of our current or past actions, attitudes are what get changed. Though not always. Plenty of other research has shown that if the attitudes or beliefs are onerous enough, people will willingly ignore or downplay their own behavior to reconcile the dissonance. But often it's more mentally efficient to just change our attitudes. For example, someone hurtling themselves out of a perfectly good airplane might think, "I'm skydiving, so I'm the kind of person who likes thrills." He's probably right, or at least I hope he is for his sake. In one clever study of this theory by Fritz Strack and his colleagues, subjects were given a ballpoint pen and told to hold it in their mouth in one of two different ways. Some were asked to hold it with pursed lips, and others were told to hold it between their front teeth, with the lips drawn up and back. As you might guess, the former tricked the subjects into frowning, while the latter got them to smile. When asked to rate the laugh-out-loud value of a cartoon, those who were being made to smile thought it was way funnier than those who were forced to frown. Their own behavior, forced as it was, affected their attitudes towards what they were seeing, which in turn made them chuckle at some silly drawing. This kind of first behavior, then attitude effect can also be hijacked in much more subtle ways, and in at least one case it was done with the help of naked ladies. University of North Carolina's Stuart Valens hooked male participants up to a monitor that beeped in time with their heart rate while they perused centerfolds from Playboy magazine. When the researchers used their control over the machine to covertly fake an accelerated heartbeat, subjects decided that they must have a thing for the particular model that they were viewing at the time. First, we perceive what we look like or what we're doing, then we draw conclusions about our attitudes and beliefs. But it turns out that behavior isn't even strictly necessary. Just thinking about how we appear to others can often affect our attitudes, which can circle back to affect our behaviors. Sometimes it's as simple as putting on a black hat instead of a white one. Mark Frank and Thomas Gilovich showed this effect by studying athletes in the National Football League and the National Hockey League. Specifically, they looked at teams that wore black uniforms versus teams wearing other colors to see if those wearing black, a color typically associated with the wardrobes of the villainous, were guilty of more infractions and associated penalties. Through a series of clever experiments, they were able to untangle the causal chain of events, showing that it wasn't just that referees were biased against players in dark clothing or that more rule breakers were attracted to teams with black jerseys. The researchers even conducted one experiment where they had subjects randomly don either a white or a black uniform, then observed that the latter tended to gravitate towards more violent activities when given a list of party games to choose from. Frank and Gilovich argued that these behaviors can be traced back to self-perception theory. I'm wearing black, I'm expected to be more aggressive, I'm aggressive. I should pick the party game where I get to shoot somebody in the face with a dart gun. Even if the whole chain of thoughts wasn't conscious, the results were there. So let's get back to Overwatch. Based on this whole first behavior, then attitude concept, I wonder what would happen if Blizzard added a kill cam kudo system where you could congratulate your opponent on his or her skill during the kill cam sequence. Just don't get cute with how you spell and then abbreviate that system. But say you get three of these kudos to give out in the course of any given match. Somebody nails you with an impressive headshot or clinches a capture point with an effective use of their ultimate attack. Kudos to them! Kudo awards could then be viewed by everybody at the end of the match. Why I think this might work is that giving out kudos is a friendly act, and if you're acting friendly, we know you're more likely to think of yourself as a friendly person who's all into sportsmanship and stuff. It's either that or bite down on a pencil while you play. All right, that's it. That's the last article. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back with the regular format for the podcast in the next episode. Hope to see you then. Thanks.